Professor Cass Sunstein is here. He is the Robert Walmsley University Professor at Harvard. From 2009 to 2012, he was administrator of the White House Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs. He is the founder and director of the Program on Behavioral Economics and Public Policy at Harvard Law School. He has testified before congressional committees on many subjects. He has been involved in constitution making and law reform activities in a number of nations, and he was recently appointed to the Innovation Board at the Department of Defense. He is the author of many articles and books, including Nudge, Improving Decisions About Health, Wealth, and Happiness, Simpler, The Future of Government, and most recently, The World According to Star Wars. He is now working on a variety of projects on the idea of liberty. Please welcome Professor Cass Sunstein.
Hello, everybody. Thank you for coming late in the day. Should I just ditch the talk and talk about Star Wars? Would you prefer that? Okay, maybe we'll get to Star Wars. Star Wars, of course, is about Jedi mind tricks, and that has to do with behavioral science, but that's all you're going to hear about Star Wars. Okay, so we'll insert a few Star Wars minutiae as we go along. Okay, so I worked in the federal government, as noted, and here's a notation on regulatory moneyball. This comes from real documents. Executive Order 13563, as it's charmingly named, directs each agency to use the best available techniques to quantify anticipated present and future benefits and costs as accurately as possible, and requires agencies to ensure the objectivity of scientific and technological information. Now, that might not seem like poetry, and it might not even seem like news, but keep in mind that as federal agencies have worked over the years, the idea of a high-level insistence on the objectivity of the underlying science and of disciplined account of costs and benefits, that has not been the, let's say, universal pattern. And so what President Obama did, and in this respect, he fortified and elaborated on an initiative undertaken by President Reagan, so this doesn't have partisan resonance. The idea was to do something like Moneyball, as depicted in the great book by Michael Lewis of that name, a book about baseball. Cricket, for those of you who don't know baseball. Quidditch, for those of you who know Harry Potter, that kind of confusing chess game in Star Wars A New Hope, for those of you who are focused on that. So to be very disciplined about costs and benefits, and that's very much connected with your enterprise. I found when I was working in the federal government, my civil servants staff, who were excellent and very technical people, would occasionally say to me, just so you know, there's a member of Congress who's very upset about this initiative. Or just so you know, there's an interest group that is quite exercised. And I found myself saying, not as a reprimand, but just from the deepest recesses of my, my cost-benefit soul. Is there such a thing? I said, that's sewer talk. Get your mind out of the gutter. Which was a way of suggesting that one, when was engaged in action for which the human consequences are serious, to think of the first two bullet points here is a pretty good idea. Okay, so in terms of charity, there's an emerging science on how to promote charitable contributions. That's something I know a lot of you have been focused on, and I'm just going to give you four little ideas here as a way of merging behavioral science and nudging with what you're engaged in. There's an idea, Save More Tomorrow, which has contributed to very significant increases in saving rates in the United States. It's a very simple idea. It's that you don't ask people to give a certain percentage of their current wages to savings because they don't want to lose savings. But if you ask them, would you like to give a certain amount of your future wage increases to savings, that they're much more amenable. The reason is that it's future money, not current money, and they're not losing what they now have. They're reducing a future gain, and it's phenomenally effective. The idea on which we have seen few experiments, but those that have occurred have been massively successful, is why not have give more tomorrow plans by which people would give an increasing percentage of their current wages or whatever to charity. If save more tomorrow works, give more tomorrow should work too. The UK government's behavioral insights team has one mantra, and it is make it easy. And the idea builds on some psychology showing that frequently if people aren't engaging in certain behavior, it's not that they need a push from behind, it's that they need simplification of the current obstacles to doing what's desired. You can push people, or you can figure out and remove the obstacles. Make it easy suggests that often when people aren't doing desirable things, it's because it's too difficult. And I'm hoping that the idea is resonating in your minds for your work, and you're thinking about ways that things could be made easier. The third idea, which I have a name for something, which if you're not familiar with the name, the concept will be obvious. It's called anchoring. So it happens that the last three digits of my social security number are 529. Don't use that to steal credit card information, please, but it's true. Guess, if you would, how many nations there are in the United Nations? In your own mind. Now, if I had said that the last three digits of my social security number are 077, the median answer in the room would be much lower than it actually would be if you'd recorded your answers, having heard the numbers 529. So the basic point is that when people are making judgments about numbers, including charitable contributions, they often are anchored on an amount. I think that's been enlisted by your organization very effectively. It turns out that if people think the social norm for giving to an entity is 300 euro, and they hear that, the amount that they'll give will be higher than if they think the norm is 200. That's a reference to social norms, and there's excellent data suggesting that when people know the norm is something like X, their behavior moves in the direction of X. By itself, that's not a stunning finding, but it's eminently usable, as in the UK Behavioral Insight Team, which has reduced tax delinquency in the United Kingdom non-trivially by telling tax delinquents that they're among a very small percentage of people in their community who are tax delinquents. Once they hear that most people are paying their taxes on time, then the level of tax compliance shoots up. This is also generally usable. I know almost everyone in this room has read and enjoyed my Star Wars book. I just tried. That's probably a failure. Okay, here's some background findings for you. In Germany, there was a recent study in which about 20,000 people were asked if they want to opt into green energy. Approximately 7% of the sample opted in, and the best prediction of whether they would opt in was whether they were in the Green Party. That's not an amazing finding. 20,000 other German households were told that they would be automatically enrolled in green energy and asked whether they wanted to opt out. In both cases, opting in and opting out was easy. It was just a switch of the default rule. The effect of switching from an opt-in to opt-out design was to increase use of green energy by tenfold to approximately 70%. And under the opt-out design, whether people were in the Green Party had no implications for whether they would sign up. It ceased to be a prediction. Okay, that is a remarkable finding of the immense authority of the default rule, and I hope you're thinking what is actually true, which is a social norm can operate as the functional equivalent of a default rule. Okay. Here are just some areas from U.S. policy that have shown the mark of behavioral economics. And I'll give you just a few examples. The first is for financial reform, our new Consumer Financial Products Bureau, which is concerned about making sure that products aren't tricking consumers, has a simple mantra, know before you owe. Know before you owe, which is a nudge, allowing people to make a wide diversity of transactions, but trying to ensure they are knowledgeable before they get into the system. Part of greenhouse gas regulation in the United States involves transparency. So there's a rule called the Greenhouse Gas Inventory Rule, which is a nudge by which everyone can see greenhouse gas emissions by the large emitters. The hope is that that will reduce emissions. With respect to default rules, I'm going to give you two data points right now. In New York, and I believe this is generalizing in large cities all over the world, there's a touchscreen where you can register your tip by pointing and clicking on a given number, which is typically in New York 20%, 25%, and 30%. If you want less, you can do that, but those are the default tips. There's a Nobel Prize-winning theorem which says that the default tips should have no implications for aggregate giving so long as the potential to give 15% or 10% or 5% is there and so long as it's pretty easy. It is pretty easy. The Nobel Prize-winning theorem turns out to be wrong. In New York, the effect of the default tips, 20, 25, 30%, has been to increase giving, and I'm using the word giving deliberately, by 10%, so that the average $6,000 tip earner in a year has been given a hefty $600 wage increase only because of the change defaults. In OECD offices, there was an experiment a few years ago in which they turned down the temperature by 1 degree Celsius. The consequence of turning down the default setting by 1 degree Celsius was significantly to decrease energy consumption and to save money. That's fantastic. And it basically worked, the default. There was also an experiment turning down the thermometer settings by 2 degrees Celsius. The consequence of that was actually significantly less than turning it down 1 degree Celsius. It's a really simple study with, I think, a profound lesson, which is a default rule will tend to stick unless it makes people too cold. Okay, the two reasons that default rules, the two conventional reasons why they work, is they profit from the power of inertia and the power of suggestion. Once the default rule is in place, you have to work a little bit to overcome it, and it has some informational content. There's also loss aversion there, which suggests that once people have a reference point, which is savings or energy, clean energy, or 25% tip, anything from that point registers at a loss, and people don't like that. What counts as a loss and what counts as a gain depends on the reference point, which is established by the default rule or the social norm. Okay, I'm just going to notice five problems here. Poverty, part of which is sustained because people don't take up anti-poverty programs which are available to them. It's a searing problem. Highway safety, where in the United States alone there are tens of thousands of deaths each year. Smoking, where there are hundreds of thousands of deaths each year in the United States, over 400,000. Mental illness, which is an extremely difficult problem because it's one of the few things to which human beings can't adjust. If you lose an arm or a leg, you're going to be okay in terms of your well-being, ordinarily. It's not a good thing, but it doesn't have the same kind of devastation that's anticipated. If you have mental illness, there is that devastation and energy in the environment. The question is, what kinds of behaviorally informed policies could help? Okay, you now know about Executive Order 13563 with its emphasis on disciplined use of cost-benefit analysis. It also has a provision which is kind of directly taking from behavioral economics. It says each agency shall identify approaches that reduce burdens and maintain freedom of choice for the public. The specified approaches include warnings, default rules, and disclosure requirements. Okay, that trilogy is important to keep in mind. More recently, less than a year ago, President Obama issued an executive order. It has the name 13707. Do you have a mnemonic device by which you can remember that? Okay, think of Star Wars episode 13707, and who's going to be force sensitive in that episode? And at the rate at which Star Wars movies are coming out, 13707 is going to be here in a hurry. Am I helping? Probably not. Okay, anyway, what makes this important is that it's an executive order which takes on board behavioral science and behavioral economics directly. Okay, here's what happened. I think in the world of government and charity, as well as very broadly, there were three ideas that dominated kind of ordinary as well as academic thinking for a couple of generations. Human beings are rational, they calculate probabilities and maximize expected value, and they respond to incentives. That's almost a haiku. The policy prescription is improve incentives. And in multiple domains of nonprofit, profit, public sector action, something like this was either the hard-won wisdom or the kind of intuitive sense of how to proceed. Okay, the behavioral objections, I think, that are relevant to your work and to public policy are five. There are five of them. The first is human beings have limited attention. And the number of things they focus on that are before their eyes is a small subset of the things that they could focus on because they're in the view screen. And one of the things you're doing, yes, is trying to put in front of people's faces something that they don't see. Do you all know about the invisible gorilla experiment? Okay, well, for those of you who know about it, let me just tell you a fact. For those of you who don't know about it, sorry. Having heard of about the invisible gorilla experiment, I told my daughter in her 20s about the experiment in which people don't see a gorilla because they're counting passes. I showed her the video, and her first reaction, having seen the video, was, "Where was the gorilla?" She's a very smart woman. What makes her comment, I think, revealing is the fact that even awareness of the limited nature of attention doesn't inoculate you from seeing things that are important, but not squarely before your eyes, because your eyes are looking at something else. Okay, the second point is that human beings show present bias. This is very much relevant to your work. It means they focus on today and tomorrow, and the future is a foreign country, later land, and they're not sure they're ever going to visit. Here's a little present bias experiment that we can conduct right now. Think, if you would, of you tomorrow on a beach in your favorite place. You're on a beach tomorrow. It happened. You're there. Now, two of you didn't do that. Please, all of you do it. Okay, now what happened for all of you, since all of you did that, is that an identifiable part of your brain just lit up. Let's call that the narcissistic part of the brain. It's the part of the brain that lights up when people are thinking about themselves, and it's identifiable. Now, if you would, think about yourself on a beach in 2018. Same beach, same you, picture yourself. For some part of the room, that part of the brain lit up again. For a significant number of you, it didn't. And the kicker is, for those of you for whom it didn't, you will want $5 today more than $10 in a week. Because for you, your future self is neurologically even a stranger. Now, even for those for whom that part of the brain lit up then, there is a tendency frequently toward present bias, which just says that the long term is not visible. And that confounds the claim that people are responsive to incentive and calculate expected probabilities. The third point is a more general one, which is that people don't always deal well with probability. In New York, not long ago, there was great fear of Ebola. It's continuing in places in the world where the statistical risk of Ebola is very low. In New York, the fear of Ebola was cascading in a time in which more Americans had married Kardashians than had died of Ebola. And people weren't going around thinking, oh my gosh, I might marry a Kardashian. It's because the event was cognitively available. This is part of the Nobel Prize-winning work of former Berkeley professor Daniel Kahneman, which says our judgments about probability are based in part on what comes readily to mind. Ebola did, highway accidents not so much, and that causes probability distortions. We know that people can be unrealistically optimistic. 80% of drivers or more have been found to be confident that they're better than the average driver and less likely to be involved in a serious accident. If you have a couple and ask both members what percentage of the household work they do, if the total isn't over 100%, you have a very unusual couple. The profession that has the most egregious form of optimistic bias appears to be university professors, where 94% have been found to think they're better than the average university professor. So far as I'm aware, 100% of human beings think that their sense of humor is better than average. Okay. That can lead to complacency with respect to real hazards. The fifth and final part of the quintess is loss aversion. Okay, we're going to do a little experiment here. Half of you, with the generosity, so to speak, of the organizers, are going to have to put 10 pounds or euros, depending on what you have, there after I'm done. Sorry. The other half of you, and this is the good news, you're going to get 10 euros from your colleagues on this half of the room. Now, the prediction is that we have a redistribution of resources, but the welfare of the room on balance will be exactly the same. That's the standard economic prediction. It's not so. Those of you who lose, this is not true, by the way. You relieved? You got to keep your money. But the fact is that if we did the experiment, the welfare of the room would go down. A loss is worse, is more bad than a gain is good. Losses activate parts of the mind that get very agitated. Gains produce pleasure, but they aren't as good as losses are bad. This is usable for purposes of charitable giving, behavior change, government. A small tax on paper bag use has a massive effect on how much paper bag use, plastic bag use, on how much plastic bag use there is. Really small tax reduces use, whereas a little bonus for bringing your own bag has essentially no impact. Okay, what makes this, I think, extremely interesting is what counts as a loss or a gain is dependent on social situations. It isn't given by nature. And I'll give you a little homely example from my experience just a couple hours ago. Coming to this conference, I decided I'd give more money to one of my favorite charities. So I went online, gave X amount of money to my favorite charity. It's not a huge amount, but it's significant. After I clicked, I noticed, oh, the default setting for your giving is not one time, but monthly. So I gave that amount every month for the next year by accident. Then I thought, I should probably go back and change it. I have two very young children. I didn't change it, not just because the default was now giving, but because of law. I thought all these people are getting some money from me for the next year. I don't want to take it out of their mouths. So what became a loss was instantaneously transformed by the fact of the transaction. I hope you're thinking that that's something you're actually observing among people who, having made a pledge, don't go back on it. Okay, here are six policy claims. Default rules matter, you know about that. Incentives may not always matter much because they might be like invisible gorillas that people don't see. Choice architecture, which is the setting against which people make decisions, is really important, and it's not avoidable. On a website, if something is first and in large font, it will have more attention than if it is last and in small font. Economists have recently discovered this in a setting where you wouldn't expect it, which the National Bureau of Economic Research sends out a weekly list of papers by the top people in the field. The papers that are listed first get more downloads. That's been published, actually, by the National Bureau of Economic Research. It's a behavioral finding about the immense importance of choice architecture, even among the people who are supposed to be the most rational of all. The economists are going at what they see first. Okay, simplicity is very important. Those are abstractions. I told you a little bit about Save More Tomorrow. Here's just data on automatic enrollment and savings plans, and there are zillions of analogies. This is in the United States, real-world data, and you can see under an opt-in design, the percentage of enrollees goes from 34% to 88% after a certain time, depending on how much money you're making. Those are the blue ones. But at every end of the income scale, automatic enrollment, and it's easy to opt out, is increasing participation rates very significantly. I think the first judgment about what's happening for people who earn under $30,000 a year should be very positive, because these are people who would suffer most at time of retirement. Just switching the default rule is giving them much more secure savings at a time when they're not going to be having any income. Okay, this is a flowchart, not the form, for the federal financial aid application. I think many charitable organizations have something like this. They make it hard, and I'll say a little bit more about the real-world consequences of difficulty. Okay, if you want to define a nudge by reference to an example, that's it. It's a GPS. That is, it's something that tells you how to get into the direction that you want to go. In the domain of giving altruistically to people who need some help, often people just need a GPS. They have at least a value that they're not able to live in accordance with because there isn't a GPS in place that helps them. This is the opposite of the invisible gorilla experiment, and it's my only scandalous slide. The men in the room know this is a urinal. Women, if you haven't seen one before, that's it. That's exactly what it looks like. But this isn't just any urinal. This is the urinal in the Netherlands airport. There's a fly painted on the urinal. That's not a real fly. It's painted there for one reason, to reduce spillage. It has been effective. It's reduced spillage by 44%. I don't know, and I don't think I want to know who calculated that number and how. Apparently, men can't help but aim at the fly. Okay, so the reason this is of more general interest than spillage reduction is it suggests if you make something salient in this way, you can have, without any kind of coercion, you can have large effects on behavior. Someone sent me this postcard fairly recently. I don't speak German, but I think I understand the slide. Okay, this is a simple idea. Take your litter home, other people do. If people are told that charitable giving is typically X percent in the relevant community, that has a big effect on behavior, and there's terrific data about that. If people are told relevant purchasing behavior in your community looks like this, that's effective. Okay, this is a cafeteria, a Nudge cafeteria, and it's reflected in some behavior by Google very recently, where Google had a cafeteria that was terrific, but also very fattening. People were eating a lot of candy and brownies. The employees who were enjoying the candy and brownies were not enjoying what was happening to their waistline. Google is a data-driven entity. It is effective whatever, but effective at what it does. And it changed the cafeteria to make sure that the healthy foods were very visible and salient, and the less healthy ones were available, but they weren't staring you in the face. The effect of cafeteria redesign was to reduce caloric intake in Google cafeterias quite significantly. Okay, so we're talking here about features of the social environment that affect choices without imposing coercion or any kind of material incentive. I think I'm going to give you a little notation here that is one of, I think, the great academic articles in the last 30 years, and it's not widely known. It's called the regulation of social meaning. Actions have meanings. In some places in the world, even now, if you buckle your seatbelt, you are accusing the driver of riskiness or confessing that you're a cowardly person. In some places in the world now, if you use a condom, you are ruining everything. There's a social, it's not romantic, or it's fearful, or it's accusatory. In other places in the world, the social meaning of not buckling up or of not using a condom is very negative. Social meanings operate as taxes or subsidies on behavior, and they often can be very stiff taxes or subsidies. And the challenge is that meanings are lived by people who don't endorse the meaning and wish it were otherwise, but they're powerless to change it on their own. They need either a social movement or the power of law to change the meaning. Okay, and here the idea is that meaning change often occurs through small nudges, which maintain freedom of choice, but take away the tax or create a subsidy. Okay, one example is calorie labels in the United States, which are having a significant effect on parts of the population. And what calorie labels are doing is making concern about caloric intake have a kind of neutral meaning, where without the calorie label, it's kind of fussy to ask about caloric intake. And what you can see from this from the federal government is a very brisk reference to some of the behavioral economics findings with which I began. There's a reference to present biased preferences, there's a reference to lack of self-control, and there's a reference to time inconsistent preferences, which have to do with neglect of the long term. Okay, for energy efficiency, I'm just going to note here that it has some of the shape of a lot of the problems that you're concerned about, where people are purchasing refrigerators and automobiles and microwave ovens that it's not in their own economic interest to purchase, because the savings over the course of 10 years or 15 years or 5 years are not highly visible to them. And what the government has tried to do, the United States government, is both to nudge through information and salience, a little like the painted fly, and through regulatory initiatives to try to get people in a position that they would be if they were attentive to the full set of costs. Okay, to orient you, here are 10 nudges. All of them are eminently usable in multiple domains. And the only one I want to put an asterisk next to of this quintet is reminders. We're getting more and more data suggesting that the impact of reminders on behavior is much larger than even the reminder enthusiasts would have anticipated. And here, of this quintet, the only one I want to put an asterisk next to is active choosing or prompted choice. And here's one way to make the idea go. How many of you, just answer this in your own minds, are planning to buy a new car in 2017? Chances are very... Say it again. Oh, so you're not planning to buy a car. How many of you are planning to buy an X, where X is something that you immediately comes into your head? Tablet, computer, bicycle. Okay. Asking that question increases the level of purchases because it brings it to mind. Okay, that's to suggest that active choosing and prompted choice often has a very large impact. Pre-commitment strategies are something that's part of your business, and it often works because people have a second-order preference, meaning a preference about their preferences, that turns out to have an impact once they register the second-order preference. The first-order preference, which might be to spend the money on ice cream rather than charity, or to have a cigarette rather than to exercise, the second-order preference defeats the first-order preference. Okay. I want to give you a slogan, plate, not pyramid. This was, I believe, the most visited website in the United States government for a significant period. There's a person, gender unclear, shoeless, marching to the top of a pyramid. Imagine you are a parent or teacher or a child thinking about healthy choices. If you look at this, do you know what you should choose? Do you know what that little white triangle at the top is? Is that death? See those stripes? Do you know why the green stripe is green and the blue one is blue and what they're mapping onto? I work on this stuff and I have no idea. Do you recognize the foods that are provided by the United States Department of Agriculture to the people of the world in order to guide them? Do you see the foods? I recognize only one. It's on the bottom right. You see it? That's a shoe. Is the U.S. government telling people that's lunch? Okay, here's what happened a couple of years ago. The U.S. government abandoned the food pyramid and replaced it with the food plate. The basic idea is that sometimes people's resistance to a certain course of action is not that they disagree, it's that they don't understand how to do it. So resistance is not a product of disagreement, it's a product of confusion about how to get there. And what's been found is the USDA food plate has gone viral because it basically says make half your plate fruits and vegetables and you're most of the way there. So when I was in the government, I had a slogan, which was plate, not pyramid. And as I've continued to work on these issues, I think that's a very good organizing principle. Plate, not pyramid. Okay, here are three examples of successful nudging. You saw the flow chart for the financial aid form. The effect of simplifying the form is equivalent to a several thousand dollar increase in the education subsidy. That's just numbers, but it suggests that simplifying a task can have the same effect as pouring a lot of money into the system. The home energy report from the company Opower, which tells people how their energy use compares to that of their peers, it's basically a social norms approach, has the same effect in decreasing energy use as an 8 to 20% spike in the short-term cost of electricity. Remember the haiku? The haiku says improve incentives. Well, improving incentives in quite a harsh way, 8 to 20% price increase, is not more effective than just telling people how their behavior compares to that of their peers. Automatic enrollment in savings plans has a much bigger impact than significant tax incentives. That confounds two Nobel Prize winning theses, and as a longtime University of Chicago person, I can barely believe I just said those words, but the data is the data. Okay, I think I'm going to end with this notation. We've talked a little bit about choice-preserving interventions, which are basically what you're all about. Yes, freedom of choice, but in a way that orients people in directions that maybe fit with their own highest aspirations. There are ways of using either pre-commitment strategies through sign-ups or of encouraging behavior in a way that's fixed and firm that maybe has an even larger effect. There's a law involving credit card use from 2009, which has saved American consumers $12 billion a year. That's tremendous. Most of that $1 billion comes from behaviorally informed approaches that are a little more aggressive than a mere nudge. We can talk about that a little bit in discussion. My last words for you are from a great Irish poet, maybe the greatest of all the great Irish poets, who said, my words for you, don't wait to strive till the iron is hot, but make it hot by striking. Thanks.
Thank you, Professor Sunstein. We now welcome Julia Galef back to the stage for a little fireside chat. Julia, this is the third time I've had the pleasure of introducing her this weekend, is the president and co-founder for the Center for Applied Rationality, an organization teaching math and cognitive science-based techniques for effective decision-making. Julia's work on rationality has been featured in publications such as The Wall Street Journal, The New York Times, Discover, Slate, Fast Company, and Vice. Since 2010, she has been the host of the popular Rationally Speaking podcast. Please welcome back Julia Galef.
Thank you, Ben. Hi.
Hey.
Thank you so much for that fascinating talk. As I was listening to you, I was struck by some real parallels between what you've so successfully done with the concept of nudges and what the effective altruist movement is trying to do. You took this simple, compelling idea about how to improve people's lives that was rooted in academic fields like economics and psychology and even moral philosophy. And you spread it widely to governments and companies and organizations around the world, all of which I think we would be very interested in doing. So my first question then is, as you've spread the idea of nudges and seen them implemented, has the idea changed? Like, have you seen it, for example, devolve in some cases into a buzzword, like green architecture has kind of become? Or maybe have you seen it mutate at all into something you had not planned or wouldn't necessarily endorse, or neither?
I think it's basically holding.
Oh, wow. What's your secret?
So I'll tell you why I think it's basically holding. That the people in the private and public sector, and there are companies all over the world and governments who think, you know, maybe it's a company that thinks I want to encourage healthy eating, mm-hmm. and if I can keep my profits stable, I'll do that. Mm-hmm. Or maybe it's a government that thinks we don't have a lot of taxpayer money to throw around, but we want to reduce crime. The idea of doing things that are based on norms or default rules or simplification, that just has appeal, and it doesn't have an ideological tension. So I think the place where the idea has migrated into something else, some skeptics like to think that there's a thin line between nudging and coercion, mm-hmm. or there's a thin line between, or no line between nudging and manipulation. Mm-hmm. So skeptics say this is really a lot like coercion, but it's pleasanter sounding, mm-hmm. or that it's really Jedi mind tricks and it's not respectful of citizens. But the users have not turned it into something else. I have a slightly academic footnote to what I just said. Will mm-hmm. you forgive?
More academic than Jedi, mind you?
No one's more academic. Nothing's more academic than Jedi stuff. But this is the slight academic footnote is there's a view out there which the public has not been interested in, but defines nudges as those things that play on people's behavioral biases.
Mm-hmm.
And as we've seen, you know, a GPS, even if you have no behavioral bias, you just don't know the Bay Area. Mm-hmm. It's really helpful. So you don't need to have to speak of behavioral biases to like a GPS or a calorie label or a pre-commitment strategy. You don't have to suffer from at least a tough behavioral bias. A pre-commitment strategy probably works if you have a disparity between what you aspire to and what you want. Mm-hmm. And that is a behavioral bias. But I think basically the term is, I think, stuck pretty well.
Well, another parallel that jumped out at me is that I think that nudging and effective altruism are both somewhat vulnerable to criticisms of or accusations of arrogance, which in the case of EA take the form of how can you presume to know which charity is best or how can you presume to know the right way to help other people, which is a little ironic because one of the main EA charities we recommend is Give Directly, where you're just letting people do what they will with the money. But anyway... And so the criticism of paternalism, I guess, or manipulation or deceit, I'm wondering if you have any kind of formal framework for thinking about what makes a nudge ethical or unethical.
Okay, great. So for the first response to the claim that nudges are arrogant is find a world in which there aren't nudges.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll find, I don't even know if there's a sign, is a black hole that, but if you have no government and no company can avoid nudging.
Mm-hmm.
So if a company has a website, it's nudging. If a government has an office where people go and pick up forms, it's nudging.
Mm-hmm.
If the government has forms, it's nudging. If there's a social security system, it will nudge people by design. If you have to apply for something, that's a nudge. If you don't have to apply for something, that's a nudge. If you have to choose whether to be in the system or not, so you can't avoid choice architecture. Any room has choice architecture. A cafeteria has choice architecture. So the idea of influences on behavior that are not neutral with mm-hmm. respect to people's choices, that's life. So for the choice architecture nudge problem, the objection to paternalism is kind of a non-starter. I think for effective altruism, it's a little different. I think it's more like the cost-benefit stuff we began with.
Mm-hmm.
If the Environmental Protection Agency is doing something about particulate matter, it had better figure out, hadn't it, whether what's the cost of doing the thing, what's the benefit from doing the thing, what's mm-hmm. the effective way to achieve the goal,
mm-hmm.
and for charity, it could anyone subject to error, but you don't want people relying on their intuitions, right? So I think
preaching to the choir. I mean,
okay. So what I'm thinking is that if you had a donor who's mm-hmm. you know a good person and wants to help, whatever, just to flail or to rely on intuitions or. That's not what the person's own goals are.
Mm-hmm.
So anyone's entitled to say to effective altruism, you know, my goal really is to go in a direction which is a bit different. I'm willing to sacrifice effectiveness because the only one I can find who's going to serve this cause isn't that effective,
mm-hmm.
but I'll trade off a little. They're allowed to say that, but to see what really works, that the paternalism objection seems... I don't know. You want to go to a surgeon if you need an operation, because
mm-hmm.
the surgeon has a sense of effectiveness. Your teeth hurt.
I agree. Yes.
Your teeth hurt. You don't. I hope no one in the room has painful teeth, or I hope I didn't just prime teeth pain. But if your teeth hurt, you go to a dentist who knows about what works. And I see it as exactly the same.
Well, the argument that the world is already nudging us seems, it feels intuitive as you say it, as I think about the nudges that you've been describing that are for the benefit of people in society. But then if I imagine nudges that were intended, you know, had selfish intentions behind them, the fact that, well, the world already has nudges wouldn't actually feel like a good objection. So there must be some implicit rule that if nudges are for the benefit of the people being nudged.
Yes, you don't want to. Okay, so nudges have a benefit over mandates, which is they preserve freedom of choice. Mm-hmm. So a calorie label allows you to say, I don't really care about calories. All I care about is taste. Mm-hmm. And if it's, you know, chocolate cake with a zillion calories, I'm going to go for it. A mandate's more intrusive. Mm. There are plenty of bad nudges out there. So there are companies that will automatically enroll you in programs that you don't need because you've bought one product from them. It's called negative option marketing, where you say one night in San Francisco for $50, and the fine print will say you're in the hotel discount program for which you're paying $40 for the next months, every month, for the rest of your life. Mm-hmm. I had something like this, by the way, for magazines. I got an offer from American Express that said, you can have three magazines of your choice for the next 3 months. That's great. I was a law professor. I thought I'd get three magazines for free. Then 15 years later, I was still subscribing to all those magazines. I had been paying for them for 14 years and 3 months. Mm-hmm. It was 14 years and 9 months. It was only my government employment where my salary... when I called them up, but they defaulted me. So completely, you can have bad nudges. But the question is, what is the direction in which people are being nudged? Mm-hmm. To say people are being nudged in a way that's selfish, or you see ineffective charities, don't you? Or people purporting to be altruistic, but they really aren't, who are nudging through misleading or... you know, factual but not full information.
I have seen that, yes.
There we go.
So there's also a gray area with things like anchoring that you were talking about at the beginning of your talk, where, you know, even if we intend it for good, still we can't claim that the interests of the nudged, we're respecting the interests of the nudged, we're respecting the interests of the people receiving the money from donations. And we can argue, I think, probably, you know, convincingly on a utilitarian basis that we're improving overall welfare, but it's still a little trickier than helping people eat healthier by their own request.
That's a great point. So you could think that a manipulation is something where people are going at the automatic processes of the human brain rather than at the deliberative or reflective systems of the brain. Mm-hmm. That's not a crazy definition. And on that view, exploiting anchoring, there's an ethical issue. I think that's fair, especially if the anchor is one that ends up getting someone to do something which really isn't in their interest. Mm-hmm. So lawyers use anchoring all the time by saying, you know, the plaintiff's demand is for $7 million. In circumstances in which you're not going to get more than $400,000, but you're hoping to get there. Or a real estate agent can say, you know, the asking price is X, where X is way above, and it's an anchor. And now those two, the lawyer one might be okay because it's in the adversary process. The real estate one might not be okay because it's exploiting people's tendency to anchor. The one we're talking about now is more ambiguous because... you're helping people. To use anchors in a manipulative way, there's a conversation to be had. Now, the data suggests that what you should do if you want to maximize giving is go to the 90th or 95th percentile of what people give. That's what the data says.
Go to meaning request that amount?
That should be the anchor. So you should...
90% of the, not the max,
of the population average. So you take the full population, what's the highest 10% or highest 5%, use that as the anchor.
So it won't seem crazy to people,
no,
but it still pulls them upward.
If you go to 98th or 99th percentile or over what anyone gives, it doesn't work anymore. Mm-hmm. But you're right. There's an ethical question. Now, it is people's free choice. People often feel great after they give money to people mm-hmm. who really need it. So it's not like the real estate situation.
Yeah, I love how we went from saying, oh, it's a very morally gray area, but here's how we would do it effectively if we wanted to do it. I have one last ethical question. I'm only, you know, spending so much time on this because I think transparency and ethics and persuading people with the, you know, reason yes. and logic instead of dark arts is pretty core to EA, which is why it's on my mind.
And to the Jedi as opposed to the Sith.
There you go. True allies. You've talked about transparency and how that's important in keeping nudges ethical, that you're not manipulating people to do things that they're completely unaware of. But can you ever really have transparency in practice instead of just in theory? Like, you can tell people, you know, hey, you can opt out of being an organ donor. There are instructions on this, you know, you have to fill out this form. And you're maybe being completely clear and forthright. But still, inevitably, there's always a segment of the population that just doesn't understand or doesn't, you know, doesn't remember or follow directions. And in practice, they end up not really realizing, they end up not opting out even though they would have wanted to. And often that's like an undereducated, underprivileged segment of the population.
That's true. That's a terrific point also, that there's data suggesting that the people who don't opt out of automatic enrollment and savings plans mm-hmm. tend to be low-income people, that they are right. especially likely to stick. And is that because they're busy? Is it because they are trusting? Is it because the fine print is just too complicated to try to fathom? We don't know the answer to that, but that's a problem. Now, one thing you could do is you could say, I'm very worried about the fact that with a opt-out design, people are going to stay in a program who shouldn't be on reflection. That is a cost. Then the question is, do you go to an opt-in design? Now, with an opt-in design, some people aren't going to be in the program.
Who would have wanted to?
And so one kind of quick and dirty way to try to figure it out is, what's the percentage or what's the number of people who are going to be losers under opt-in, and who are losers going to be opt-out?
And how much does losing cost you?
Both.
Yeah.
So both the magnitude of the loss and the numbers of people who are losing. That's one way to do it. If you think that both opt-in and opt-out are lousy because you have too many losers, then there's a good argument for active choosing.
Right.
So for organ donation, one idea, and I'm hoping you're thinking of analogies, there's real problems with opt-in design. People don't go into organ giving who would, but they're creeped out by the I have to do some work, or and under opt-out, people are in, some of whom are in inadvertently. That might be a problem. So just ask them. Say when you get your driver's license, you want to be an organ donor or not?
Empirically, what's the rate of donation compared to both opt-in and opt-out?
It tends to be in the middle. So the
dramatically closer to either?
Not dramatically closer on average, but I'll give you some very cool data, which is something I'm now working on. Which is, in a survey setting, we find that in the environmental context, if people are defaulted into green energy, more people will end up green than if they have to opt in. That's the German study. Mm-hmm. That's not amazing. We find if you ask people whether they want to be in green energy or not, there is more green energy than under opt out. I'll explain. I did this with, it's in the Berkeley's Environmental Law Journal, the Ecology Law Quarterly, and I did not expect this finding. I did it with a student co-author, and I think I can explain it, which is that our population in an opt-out design included people who thought, who do you think you are, opting me in against my will to green energy? And they opted out irritated. But, and this is relevant to effective altruism,
uh-huh.
under active choosing, people didn't feel irritated. They felt, okay, it's up to me, and I'll go green. And we did independent measures of their guilt and their madness. And under opt-out, there was a madness factor, not under active choosing. And under active choosing, there was a guilt factor, stronger than under opt-out.
Interesting. We have just a couple minutes left. I want to switch tacks now and talk about something you've written about elsewhere, about the dangers of ending up in echo chambers where the process of talking, deliberating, seemingly reasonably, rationally can end up promoting views that aren't necessarily that justified, but just have sort of, cascaded up to the top. And I know effective altruism is very concerned about avoiding echo chamber effects. Do you have any advice for us, any heuristics or policies we should have?
Okay, I'm thinking that in multiple settings, if you have like-minded people getting together, they tend to end up more confident, more unified, and more extreme.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for some organizations, like the anti-slavery movement, or the movement for same-sex marriage, the increase in confidence and extremism and unity because of like-minded, that's really good.
Mm-hmm.
That's indispensable. And there are two things that are good about it. They add, even if their internal diversity is squelched, they add diversity to the society's stock of stuff. And there's another thing which is, I think, connected with effective altruism, though less poignantly than in other contexts. There are some people who have ideas, but they think that it's just them that has those ideas.
Mm-hmm.
So they're subject socially to a kind of epistemic injustice.
Mm-hmm.
It may be, people are suffering from police brutality or sexual harassment, and they need the echo chamber so that they're among like-minded people. Okay, what I think is a legitimate concern for anyone who's evidence-based mm-hmm. is that the stock of informational inputs is too narrow, both on the kind of empirical side and on the value side.
Inputs to the community? Or
to the community.
To the discussion?
To the discussion. So
okay.
When I was in the government, I felt that there's a pervasive risk of happy talk, where happy meaning we're doing everything right and good.
And yes.
Yeah. And so there'd be nodding and enthusiasm and let's go for it. And the public comment process in government, which was kind of external scrutiny, that is, who would have thought the public comment process completely indispensable to crush happy talk? because the left will come in and say, this makes no sense, and the right too, and a certain percentage of the time they'll be right. And so what I would think, both on the values and the empirical side, to talk to people who think that you are really wrong,
mm-hmm.
probably, given my understanding of what you do, they will be usually mistaken, but they'll have some ideas.
We'll try to, have you heard the term steel man? It's like the opposite of straw man. You try to, find the more charitable, stronger version of their case than they in fact made themselves.
Oh, that's great.
So we can try to steel man our critics.
That's great. Okay, so there's an idea in the government, red teams. It's not like devil's advocates. It's like steel man, where you get someone there whose goal is to show the vulnerability in the course of action that's being taken.
Yeah.
And they if they're sincere, and they don't feel they're engaged in an exercise, they can change things.
Be really valuable. Cool. Well, we're unfortunately out of time, but it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. All thanks to you.
I appreciate your talk.
Thank you.